Swagat Hain, which is welcome in Hindi. Welcome to the Daddy Unscripted podcast. My name is Tim Wheaton. I am the host and the creator of Daddy Unscripted podcast. I am trying to help you all, give you a little bit of extra something with all of my episodes. So I start them and finish all of them in a different foreign language. And because maybe that seems weird to some of you, if this is your first or second time coming to the podcast, I just give a little extra to everyone with a greeting and a farewell in a foreign language. It's just my little bonus gift to you. And I'm super jazzed. Oh, I'm doing some stuff here already, and you'll know about it later. But I'm doing some stuff in giving you little nuggets of foreshadowing to this episode with myself and Amar Sastry. I didn't even ask him if that's how I'm supposed to pronounce his last name, so I may have got it wrong. If I did, Amar, I apologize. But Amar is part of the Osiris Media family. He is all over Twitter, and I'm sure a lot of you know him, follow him, love him, are wowed by him, like I am, all of those things, 100%. And I will tell you, like, you can find Amar in a ton of different places, but some of the big ones are he does the video version of The Drop by Osiris, which you can find on YouTube. You can also find his Anatomy of a Jam videos on YouTube. You should check out his website, amarguitar.com, and find him. I'll put stuff in the show notes. He throws out all his stuff at the end of the episode. But before we get too much deeper, I'm going to do a little bit of business here.
Osiris.
Hi, I'm Ben Sawyer, and I'm the co-host of the Road to Now podcast on the Osiris Podcast Network. Each week, my partner Bob Crawford and I speak with experts to discover how history has shaped the politics, culture, and economy of the world we inhabit. I'm a history professor and stand-up comic, and Bob is a founding member of the Avett Brothers with a deep knowledge of history and theology. Together, we work to bring history to the public in a way that is informative, accessible, and, we hope, entertaining. You can find the Road to Now podcast anywhere you get this Osiris podcast or on our website at www.theroadtonow.com. That's www.theroadtonow.com. We hope you'll join us on the road and that you thoroughly enjoy this episode of our fellow Osiris podcast.
Osiris.
So let me just tell you, I'm not sponsored by this in any way. I haven't talked to Brandon about this or anything. But I want you guys to bookmark this as well and go check this out. This is for you guys, you men, you guys with beards, which sounds sexist. Some of you ladies may be growing, you know, I've seen The Greatest Showman. I know it's out there, but truly, any of you guys with beards, check out wolfmanwhiskers.com for amazing beard balm that balm, kind of like caulk. It's got an L in there that we don't say all the time. Caulk is not cock, it's caulk. And balm is balm, not bomb. So this way people don't think that you are saying something bad, negative, whatever, scary. You're using beard balm. So go to wolfmanwhiskers.com. They have a bunch of different scents. They make amazing beard care products. So again, I'm just throwing this out there. I have no affiliation with Wolfman Whiskers, but just letting you know, if you have a beard and you, like me, are trying to not put off your significant other by your facial hair that you really care about and want to have, and you want it to be softer potentially, you maybe even want your skin to be nice underneath it, and you maybe want to have a nice little welcoming scent to it, wolfmanwhiskers.com. That's all I'm going to say. Okay, now we are ready to get into this episode where Amar and I talk about a ton of stuff. It's very funny because, again, I'll let you behind the curtain a little bit here. We were thinking we were going to have to do like a 45-minute show, even maybe even a little bit less, because we kind of started late, my fault, And then he thought he was going to have to get on a different call with somebody. So I kind of stopped it and told him, this is a great segue spot. Let's come back to this whenever we can start recording the second half. And his call got canceled and we got to keep going. And so this was just a completely natural, amazing conversation with a guy that I really enjoy and really was so stoked to have this time to get to know him better and to be able to talk with him about fatherhood and life. And we just kind of jumped right in and we started talking about him being a new dad and all of that. And then we kind of rewound back to his dad and we got into that whole life. And then we talked about his music and all of the stuff that he does. There's some life lessons in here. We even laid out some great knowledge tidbits, some nuggets of knowledge, you might say. We might have created some catchphrases here. One great little thing that his dad gave him not so many years ago. There's just really good stuff in this episode. So it may look a little bit longer time-wise than some of the other episodes, but I am telling you, just take the time to chew through this one because there's excellent stuff in here. And Amar, I cannot thank you enough for the time and thank him enough for the time and his family giving that time to us to be able to have this conversation. But B, great guy. You're going to love this episode. You're going to love his take on life and his very unique perspective because of his very unique life path. So without any more of my shalapal that I'm doing at the beginning of this, which I don't know if that's a word, but I made it up and I accept the TM at the end of it as we go into the episode with myself and Amar. I like to think I've got a couple of years left in me. I was talking with my friend and he said, I think we're like at our halfway point. I feel confident saying that. And I said, if I make it to 94, that will be amazing.
Right? Yeah. I mean, and you will, you know, especially with technology and health advancing ridiculously fast. You know, it's going to happen.
Yeah. I might need to go like gluten-free or something free or something like that to make it work. But I don't know. I love gluten.
Yeah, I did gluten-free for about a year and it did wonders for me. I had really bad allergies and it weirdly like fixed a lot of those problems, but I missed beer and bread too much. I love beer. I love bread.
And yeah.
Couldn't do it.
Bread, I couldn't do. My brother does gluten-free and he's a big bread person too. And he found like one brand that he kind of will admit that it's okay. It's passable. But beer, like they're starting to make more gluten-free beers and I guess they're okay. And then you could go on the, what, White Claw and Truly, are those gluten-free?
Sure. I think they are, yeah.
If you wanted to jump on the seltzer bandwagon.
Sure, yeah. I mean, it's I'm a big fan of wine. So when I drank a lot of wine and that was good. But yeah, I just miss even gluten-free bread. Never did it for me. Just like, you know, you said, it's you can find a passable bread.
Yeah.
About it. It's never
totally.
Even like a piece of stale, quote unquote, real bread, I think is better than like the fresh gluten-free bread. Maybe I'm being gluten-free. I don't know.
No, that's, I think that's totally right. Like my wife will try to do gluten-free pasta for the kids and I always raise my nose to that.
There's this one restaurant by me that does the best gluten-free pasta I've ever had in my life.
Oh, and really?
Even though I'm not gluten-free, I still get a gluten-free when I'm there.
Oh, wow.
It's that good. And I don't know what they do. It's out of control.
That says something because gluten-free pasta can absolutely suck.
Oh, yeah. It's like cardboard confetti.
Yeah. Even cleaning it, like cleaning the dishes from the gluten-free pasta makes me
feel weird.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. As it should. You're on the right track.
Yeah. So we're in it already, but I will say for all of you that are here now, I am here with Amar, just Amar, who is not just Amar. That's the thing. Amar does so many different things with Anatomy of a Jam, with Osiris now as the host of the video version of The Drop. You're doing other things with Osiris, yeah?
Yes, we're working on a podcast about music technology in partnership with the company Splice, which is super exciting. I love that program. It's a platform for music creators to get samples and loops and to share their and share their content. It's we're working on a podcast with them, and it's coming along really well. So I'm super excited about that.
Oh, that's awesome. Anyhow, welcome, Amar, to Daddy Unscripted. Thank you so much for being a part of this show today.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. So I was really excited when I saw that you were just recently had become a dad. And I think that was in your interview on fish.net and talking about all of the new juggling that you were doing in your life. So how old, you have a little girl?
Yes, that's correct. A little girl. She's about a year. She just turned a year old a couple of months ago. She's about 14 months now.
Oh, wow. Yeah, you can tell she's young because you're still doing the month thing. That's the math starts getting harder and harder. And like, you know, people, there is definitely the cutoff time. And I used to love people who were going beyond the 3-year mark in months. And I'm like, if you're saying something over 40 months, that's, you've gone too far.
Oh, way too far. That's, yeah, that's, it's absurd math. I mean, I can barely add my grocery bill and I pull up my iPhone when it's time to calculate the tip. I mean, yeah, it's not happening after, I think after 2 years is probably when I cut off the month thing.
Yeah, that's probably good. Anybody who says like, if your baby is 2.5 years old and you're saying 30 months instead of 2.5, like just.
I think at that point, you're just trying to say you're really good at math.
Yeah.
You're signaling like, hey, which is fine. Hey, you know, like that's, if I could do it, I would. But yeah, she's 64 months old.
Yeah, solid brag. Let me work out the math. And by that time, the kid is already telling you, I'm 10.
Right.
Or whatever it is. I did horrible math on that, but whatever. So yeah, you are in the early stages, and we'll go in the past in a little bit, but how is all of new daddydom going for you?
I'm super, super lucky that it's been amazing for me so far. I mean, my wife does most of the hard work, as I guess a lot of mm-hmm. wives do. But
big ups to the wives,
right? You know,
and moms.
It's,
yeah,
it's I absolutely could not feel sane without her. But she's just an amazing mom and an amazing person, and I feel lucky that my daughter gets to have her as a role model, because she's probably, my wife's one of the strongest people I've ever met, and she's a huge inspiration to me. But the funny part about being a dad is every day it feels like it's completely different. Like every, you know, it's like one day she can't even crawl, the next day she's like flying across the carpet running, you know what I mean? It's like, it's every day it's just change after change, and she always blows my mind. Like one day, like she could barely, she was just mumbling, and the next day it was dada dada, you know, those were her first words. And just every day my mind is blown by something she does. Which it sounds almost corny, but it seems pretty like most dads can, or parents in general can relate to that.
Right. I think all of, especially when us dads are talking about it, it sounds even cheesier, because it's like men talking about babies, which I guess just seems weird. Like, just like you said, when you're a dad, you just get it. Like, there is something completely different about that world. And it sounds wrong to any of you who are not dads. So I'm not trying to like say that we're better or whatever, but there is definitely a very big difference in everything. Like, your outlook on the world is different, I swear.
Completely. It's like I feel like there was a me before being a dad and me after.
Mm-hmm.
And which is weird, because at the same time I feel like an 18-year-old kid trapped in like a 30-year-old plus, you know what I mean? Like
yeah,
I feel like a child myself, mentally, not you know. But it's and that's another thing, like my wife and I will look at each other and be like, can you believe we have a kid now? Like who the hell let this happen, you know?
They let us leave the hospital.
I know, right? What were they thinking? Yeah. I swore to myself that, maybe I didn't swear, but I was like, I'm never going to be one of those dads that like all these little moments that affect me so deeply now, like when I'll walk in the door and she'll run towards me and say dada and like wrap her arms around me, like, and I just totally melt. I just never thought that would have such a deep impact on me, like the little day-to-day moments. But I look forward to those moments kind of more than anything. And I know a lot of people that travel for work very frequently, a lot of musicians especially that are on the road a lot. I can't imagine how heartbreaking it must be to always be on the road. And, you know, especially when you have young kids, to not see them that much. I know that's a reality for a lot of people. And it's, you know, when I'm away from her for like a week or two, it's like horrible. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, a Skype conversation. Technology is great that I get to see her, but I feel way more attached to her than I thought I would be. I don't know if that sounds like a bad dad thing to say.
No.
Maybe it's because I'm an only child, so I never really had that camaraderie with maybe like a younger being in my life. But especially since she's so helpless and like that, you know, it's all the dad instincts, man. The dad instincts, that's what really trips me up. It's like I have no reflexes. Like I'm like a sloth, but when she like almost falls over and like I'll like scoop and pick her up before she hits the floor, my wife's like, how did you do that? You'll trip on your own feet like walking around the kitchen. Like, how do you, you know? And it just changes you, man. It's so crazy. The weirdest part is also how babies are they live between kind of two extremes. And on 4th of July, we went to a fireworks show and we put the little, you know, baby headphones on. So it blocked all the loud sound. And, it, you know, I put the headphones on and you could, it was definitely protective, but you could still clearly hear the loud booms.
Yeah.
And she fell asleep. Like, how do you fall asleep?
Amazing.
In this loud noise when a creak from like two rooms away will wake you up in the middle of the night, you know? And it's like, she always surprises me every day. Every day is anew. And the one thing parents always say is that being surprised is something that it's going to happen to you pretty much every day for the rest of your life as a parent.
Yeah.
Always going to surprise you.
And it's cool. Like there are two sides to that, and that things move so fast and they're always changing. And that's something I always find myself. I try not to give a lot of advice to parents because my number one thing of advice that I always say to people is, do what works for you and don't listen to everybody else and don't get too like engulfed by the books and the rules, quote unquote, of what you're supposed to do. Because, you know, you can be that parent that says, I'm never going to rock my baby to sleep or whatever. I'm going to put them in their crib and they are going to fall asleep. And if it takes 10 hours of screaming every night, then so be it, because they need to learn that on their own. But if you are about to murder every single person that crosses your path on a daily basis because you are not sleeping and you are like afraid of what you might do to your child because they are not sleeping, like that's when you break it down a little bit and do what works for you and your baby. You know,
that's smart, man. You know, it's good to have an open mind. It's also good to listen to, you know, yourself, your intuition. I think maybe this is kind of self-reflecting here, but I feel like a lot of times we put our intuition aside and we're like, oh, well, this, just like you said, like, oh, this book said this expert said this, and we'll kind of muffle our own internal voice in favor of someone else's that we may value more. But I agree with you all the way. It's, you know, dealing with absolutes a lot of times when it comes to I'm going to do this or I'm never going to do this is not always the best course of action. And I love getting parenting advice. I love, at least I'm open to parenting advice because I'm so ignorant about it. So I love, you know, but the one thing that, just like you said, anytime a parent gives me advice, they pretty much always say the same thing that you just said to me. They're like, it's not a black and white case, but here's what I do.
Yeah.
And that's an experienced parent coming at you.
Totally.
So I appreciate that.
Yeah. Hearing the different things that people have tried that worked is great. Like, you now have different options that you can pick and choose from. But like, these are individual little humans that are not those people's little humans, and they are not in their environment, and they have different parents. Like, everything is different with every household. So thinking that what worked for the Joneses is going to work for you, or absolutely should work for you and your child, is just kind of silliness, I think. So
I think that's spot on. I think it's getting to the core of what you said. It's about, you know, listening and observing to what works and what doesn't work. Whereas if you're always doing this or always doing that, and you're not kind of getting any feedback from your kid, I think that's a lot of times a recipe for disaster.
Yeah. And what one of the things I was going to say is, like, the good thing about things coming and going really quickly sometimes is remembering that when it's the bad times, this is going to pass. this teething episode or whatever it may be is not going to last forever. And it may seem like it, and it may feel like it, and it may be, you know, this one is a week as compared to the last one that's 2 days, but like you and your child are going to make it through that. So sometimes you just got to ride the wave and I don't know, hold on for dear life.
I mean, I couldn't have said it better, because, you know, it's all of these little micro sections of their lives that happens at this age, coming from where I am, and it feels like it's lasting forever. You know what I mean? It's mm-hmm. like, felt like the time from when she couldn't talk to when she started saying her first words felt like an eternity. You know, when she was crawling and not walking, it felt like forever, but it was probably like a month or two at the most. And it's just, time just has a really weird way of expanding and contracting in a way I've never felt before I became a parent. It's got such a weird, time just totally, it has like a different meaning to me. I think on Mark Maron's podcast, I can't remember which episode of WTF, but he mentioned that, you know, he was saying, Mark, he doesn't have any kids. So he's like, I don't see time passing the same way a lot of my friends who have mm-hmm. kids, you know, they see, you know, like, you know, the baby teeth and the braces and the junior prom, they like see their life in a completely different way than he was saying that he does. And he wasn't saying it's better or worse, but he was saying how different his view of time is than his parent friends.
Yeah, that's true. It totally, like, the measurement is right there, staring you in the face from a very low place on the ground, and then from a place that's closer to your knees, and then eventually they're like taller than mom and talking back to you and whatever. Like, it's absolutely like the judge is right, not the judge, but the judgment of time is right there for you.
Well said. That's exactly right. I can... Yeah, she went from being a tiny peanut that could hold my hand, and now she's, you know, biting my knees when I'm wearing shorts. So, well, yeah, I totally agree with that.
Yeah, you savor those times before they're like standing, walking, grabbing everything, and they're all like different phases of life, and you roll with it.
And that's what really messes me up, is because when I was telling people that, I was like, oh, you know, my wife's pregnant, they were so excited, and people would always say this one phrase, you know, especially after the babe, after she was born, they'd always say enjoy it. And I remember the time I was thinking, like, again, me with zero experience with
yeah, kids, yeah.
And like, you know, my nieces and nephews here and there, but, you know, it's like, what's there to enjoy about a baby? Like, what, like, I never said this out loud, but I was thinking, I was like, I mean, I get what they're saying, kind of, but then after about maybe like a week into newbornness, I remember like holding her and she was like looking around and she fell asleep in my arms, and like my entire body felt like covered with this incredible, like it was like my soul was covered in a blanket. And I was mm-hmm. like, oh, this is what they were talking about. You know what I mean? It's mm-hmm. like that incredible feeling that I've never gotten that feeling from anything on the planet, but, you know, just holding your child as, you know, as they fall asleep in your arms, for example, and I was like, oh, this is why people have kid after kid.
Yeah, this is why there's parents with 8 children in a van. Yeah. Which I'm not telling you to do, Amar.
Hey, you're not the boss of me, Tim. If I want to have that's 8 true. That's kids, true. And I'm just kidding. I do actually have a friend who has 9 children, and believe it or not, he is a very well-adjusted person. Wow. So much of the fact that I'd known him for like a year before he's a musician, he's a drummer, killer player. And I had no idea, like he's so normal, I don't want to say normal, but he's so like, I figured that someone with 9 kids would be, you know, exhausted and irritable all yeah. the time. At least I would be, but he's not. And his kids are well adjusted, his wife is very well, you know, like I feel like he's got to be an exception to the rule. I also don't know many people with close to a dozen kids, so maybe I'm projecting. But
yeah, and you said you're an only child. What about your wife?
She's got sisters, and we talk about this all the time, about whether we want to have more kids, whether you mm-hmm. know whether or not, and it was a little bit hard for me growing up being an only child, because I always felt, because my parents were working, you know, 50, 60 hours a week, that I didn't get to see them a lot when I was a kid compared to a lot of other kids. But, you know, I always told her, I was like, I don't want our daughter to be an only child, because, you know, I don't want her to go through that same thing. And now I've kind of backtracked, because my wife and I spend so much time with her.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, now I'm thinking that, yeah, maybe I was wrong about what I said. Maybe it's mm-hmm. more about the, you know, kind of feeling the attention and stuff. But you know, it's things change. So I haven't really, no decisions are made till they're made, you know.
Mark it down. Yeah. And you guys are still young. So it's not like you're 45 and having to like, okay, we got to do this now or never. Like you've sure. got time.
Do you know what's terrible about if you have a kid over 40 and this is, I don't know if this is like a regional thing, but if you're a woman over 40 and you're having a pregnancy in the medical world, and one of my friends, they recently had their first son, their second child, and my friend's wife is over 40. And that's how I know about this. If you're over 40 and you have a child, they call it a geriatric pregnancy.
Oh boy.
Isn't that the harshest thing? I was like,
yeah.
I mean, again, this is, it's completely medical terminology. It's not meant to be a judgment, but I can't, you know, like it's as if women don't have it harder. You're just gonna, you know, hey, throw that in there.
Yeah. Oh gosh.
I don't know why that makes me irrationally, like when he told me that, I got like viscerally angry for no reason. Not like, you know, it's like
on her behalf. Yeah.
On her behalf. And she wasn't even that angry. She's like, oh, it's fine. I was like, no, Kristen, don't you understand?
We've got to fight this. Yeah.
Let's go to City Hall.
Well, and they used to have like back when, gosh, I don't remember how old I was, but quite a while ago, they had this big thing about kids having kids. That was like a term because there were so many teenage pregnancies. I mean, this was definitely over a decade ago. And so, you know, I guess we should just wait for them to start a special on like calling it seniors having kids or something and really drilling it down for people over 40.
Sure. Of course. That would be the natural course of things.
Which is so funny because now, like, it, you know, I get it. I've heard all the stats and where the at-risk situation is over a certain age and whatever. But like nowadays, that is so normal. And it's not like the I was going to say it's not like the 60s where, or even earlier, but I was born to my mom when, oh gosh, I've for no good reason, I've never done the math on this, but she was just shy of 41 when she had me. So, and that was, you know, in the 70s. So I can't imagine like what kind of eyebrow raising she got from people.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Times have surely changed since then, that now if you have a child when you're over 40, people don't even really blink.
No.
So, and for good reason, I think there's no, you know, there's definitely, and I don't know what the age cutoff is, but I know as you get to a certain age, you get, you know, your child has increased complications of possibilities of complications, et cetera.
Yeah.
But, I mean, medical technology, especially fertility technology now, from what I understand, has gotten so good to the point that I know many people, again, this is anecdotal evidence, but I know a lot of people over 40 that have children and they're fine, their kids are fine. And hey, look at you, Tim, you're doing A-okay. I mean,
yeah.
there's nothing to worry about here.
It's funny because I, you know, when I was in junior high and high school and my dad would come to like sporting events and stuff, before people got to know who he was, I remember clearly multiple occasions where people would say, oh, your grandpa came to watch you play this game today? That's so cool, about my dad, because he was so much older. And now I think, to me, like I'm one of the coaches on my son's baseball team. And when I see a younger dad, that's more out of the norm to me. That's more surprising, like seeing any of these kids with like a dad in their young 30s or even younger than that. You know, it's so kind of casual now for older people to have kids. So you go, geriatrics, I think is the thing we're trying to really get across here to people that are my age.
You know, you do you, man. You know, everyone listening, man, everyone's on their own path. And I think Tim's hitting the nail on the head here. You know, it's that stigma, you know, needed to be removed. And I think it's feels like it's more typical for people to have kids in their 30s now than ever before. Mm-hmm. 30s and 40s and later. And now it's gotten to the point that, you know, anyone I know in their 20s with a kid, they feel like it's a rarity now. It
right.
feels like it's happening less and less. And I know there's a lot of societal reasons for that. But you know, I know I definitely was not ready in my 20s to have a kid. Right? That's what everyone says, right?
You know? Yeah. Can you imagine? I say that without knowing you, but about myself, like I think that same thing. Like I cannot imagine trying to responsibly and properly parent a child in my anything younger than like 27 for sure.
Right. Right. And it's a pretty recent change, right? From what I understand, that for almost all of our civilization, people were having children in their teens and 20s.
Yeah.
For like millennia, right? Like that's the way it's always been. But the thing is, and correct me if I'm wrong, it feels like people would have kids and they basically try to like scrape and like, you know, get their stuff together on the way up. But now it feels like we want to have everything. We want to have our shit together before we have a kid. At least that's how, you know, that's how I felt. How a lot of my friends feel. It's like, I want to, you know, get everything kind of locked down and not have to, you know, worry about keeping the lights on. When that baby comes.
Mm-hmm. And that's the thing. Like, I think for a lot of them, it's not just the, I want to sow my wild oats, or I want to get my traveling out or whatever it may be before I have my kid. I have to get my yayas out. It is a lot of looking at it in a way of responsibility. And to some, you know, we're obviously talking in a lot of generalizations here, but I think to some people, like, I can't remember who I was talking with recently, one of my recent guests, about this, but they kind of felt like potentially they were being a little overly cautious, you know, not doing it as early as they possibly could have, but they really wanted to make sure they had that nest egg ready, or whatever you would say, for them to bring a child responsibly into their family so that they didn't feel like they did have to do that scraping.
Sure. To me, that seems incredibly responsible. You know, it feels like looking at foresight and there's so many reasons to have a kid. And it almost, I feel like a lot of parents say that you never really even feel ready, even when it happens, which I totally agree with. I think with every passing year, you probably feel, again, speaking generally, you probably feel more ready than you were the year before.
Yeah. So on that point, and talking about what people used to potentially do in the past, I think that makes for our time to potentially segue into kind of your history and going back into your dad, your parents, and potentially even further than that. So why don't you take us down that road of leading up to Amar today?
Sure. Yeah. I was born in India in the 80s, and my folks or my mom and dad are both Indian. So we're like, we joke that we're like millionth generation Indian. You know how people say, oh, I'm like third generation. We don't know. That was the first time anyone in our family tree that we know of has left the motherland. Mm. So I left India when I was pretty young, probably about 5, 6. I still have memories and stuff from there.
So I'm going to pause you. So go back into your dad and when was he born and his life a little bit there in India, speak on that.
Sure. Yeah. He was born in the 50s and he grew up in rural ass India. I mean, so rural, it makes Iowa look like Brooklyn, you know, like it's and I've been there and it's really pretty, pretty desolate. And the tough part is I never really got to know my grandparents. Both my dad and my mom are amongst the youngest. They each have on their side, they each have like 7 brothers and sisters. So I've got like 14 like blood uncles and aunts, and you know, they're all married. So I've got more cousins than I have hairs on my head, you know. So
yeah,
it's a very, very big family. But you know, my dad, he spent most of his, pretty much all of his life in India, never really traveled, never did anything like that. He was always kind of a working stiff. And one thing that both on my mom's side, my dad's side, all 4 of my grandparents, they really stressed that education was kind of the ticket out, that education was, you know, that's what, you know, brought civilization, brought us out of the jungles and into, you know, heated homes, you know, like education is the way forward. So they really stress that, which I thought that was the norm in India until I went there and realized that it wasn't, that was pretty And they're pretty ahead of their time to be like, you know, formal education is your ticket out of this place. Not that it was, you know, a bad place, but, you know, they wanted their, you know, their kids to do better than them and not to not have to struggle. So my dad really took that to heart, and he is probably the hardest working person I know. Kind of, he's always, you know, and it wasn't working to necessarily to work, but it was working in service of your family, you know, working to always be better and provide what, you know, he wanted to provide me what he never had himself. Mm-hmm. And I know when he was very young, his parents sent him away to boarding school, and it wasn't, you know, cause he misbehaved or anything. He's a pretty mild mannered person. But it was more like that, you know, the schools around here, from what I know of the story, the schools around here are kind of trash. We're going to send you to where you can really excel. Cause he's a really, really smart guy, always kind of outperforming anyone around him in school. So that was, I know that was really hard for him, kind of growing up away from his parents, not really seeing them ever. And I know that was hard for my grandparents, but it ended up being really good because he, you know, worked his way that he could get out of India and come to America. And I didn't realize this, but I still don't really realize how hard it was to get a visa to get out of India and to come to America, even in the early 90s when we moved here. Apparently, like it's not something they just hand out. I'm very, very ignorant about that. But you know, it's something that you have to work really hard towards, in terms of getting a sponsor and all that kind of stuff. And I know they made a lot of sacrifices to kind of do that. And my dad is not a musician. He jokes that, like, when I was like learning how to play guitar, and I was like, "Hey dad, come check out this cool riff." And he had this one line that he still says to this day when we talk music, he's like, it's like you're playing Mozart to a water buffalo. That's what he like anytime, like no matter what it was. And we still joke about that. He still says that today, but he really instilled in me a very, very deep love for music. I know when he was saying that when he was growing up, he was listening to stuff like Zeppelin and, He was trying to, and this is something that I, it's so hard for me to realize in context because I grew up, you know, like it's such a normal sound to hear, you know, Jimmy Page and John, but he always tried to instill in me like how groundbreaking that was and how that, you know, all that kind of stuff sounded nothing like that at the time, and how like every band that came after the other in that era was just like turned the world on its head. And he always, despite not being, you know, a musician or in his words, having any kind of, you know, knowledge about it, he really understood it from like that soul level, that, you know, that really, you know, to what it means to really love music. And he's glad that I play music, because he's like, not only did I not want to play music, I had no interest in it, and I was the complete opposite. So that was a big thing for him, because he was always, to him, music is, he calls it like a sacred art. You know, it's God singing to us through these various little forms that we call musicians. Right, that's how he always looked at music. And my whole, kind of speaking of that, my whole family tree is also very, very religious. I'm Hindu, and the whole family tree is Hindu. That was a big part of them too, is kind of having what they call a healthy fear of God, you know. And that again, something that's very hard for me to relate to, but that was another big part of them trying to, by them I mean, you know, grandparents, parents and all that, trying to be as good as, trying to work as hard as possible, is that, you know, you, despite being the religion that believes in reincarnation, you really only have one shot at least in this cycle, in this life form. So you really have to make the most out of every chance you get. And you know, experiment, try doing stuff that you may think you're not good at it, you know, just give it a shot. And, you know, anytime one of the best lessons I learned from my dad is, I remember like trying to do my homework, and I was like, "Oh dad, can you help me with this math problem?" And he'd be like, "Oh, all this new math bullshit. I don't understand. Okay, I'll give it a shot." And he'd try to help me, and I'd get something right and be like, "This is easy." That's what I would say. And then I'd try something. I was like, "I don't get this. This is hard." And he would always instill in me that, you know, he's like, there's no real thing as easy as or hard. You know, you got the first problem because you knew the process of how to arrive at the answer. That's why it seemed easy. The second problem, you didn't quite understand how to get to the solution, so you thought it was hard. In fact, you just do this and this, and you can see that the second problem is easy as well. You just have to know how to break it down into smaller pieces. And he's very academically minded, so that was, and I'm not, so that was a very big a help to me, that he, you know, he trying to teach me how to think in terms of like looking at a problem and saying, you know, try to break down a problem into smaller pieces. And I'm talking real simple, like third grade shit here too. You know, like I'm not, it's not like I wasn't doing
not trigonometry.
Not trigonometry, no calculus. This is like I was in like eighth grade and I was like, Dad, what does this X mean? He's like, oh, it's multiply, you dummy. No, he didn't say that. But you know what I mean? It's like,
yeah,
that was a really big impact on me that he, you know, he was saying that because he was so academically minded and gifted, he was always saying that you can really learn how to do anything you want if you just can get over your kind of initial fear of the unknown. I think that had a big impact on me.
Yeah, I can see that being on a much different and higher level, like fitting perfectly into kind of your whole anatomy of a jam thing.
Oh, thanks, man. Yeah, it's one of the most important things I think anyone has ever said to me was something that he said to me, and he said it to my dad said to me out of the blue. And it was around the time that I started making all those videos and stuff. That was, believe it or not, a big inspiration. And I remember we were sitting like watching a movie, and my dad and I, we are the king of comfortable silences. Like we can sit next to each other and literally not like talk for an hour. And it's not awkward. It's not like, oh, what am I going to say? Like it's the most natural thing. Mm-hmm. And we'll just like turn to each other and say something, or, you know, here and there and have a conversation, but it's very natural. And we were having one of those moments. I think we were watching, I think we love trying to turn each other on into new music, and then we get angry when the other person doesn't like it. But I played him, I think it's a pretty common thing, but I played him, I think it was Jeff Tweedy solo. He loves Bob Dylan. So I was like, oh, I think maybe he'll like Jeff Tweedy. So I remember playing Jeff Tweedy, and he kind of liked it, and we were listening, and we were just sitting there, and then he turns to me and he said, "It took me a long time to realize that most of the fears I had were completely in my head." And he just, we went back to listening, and like, that moment just kind of sat with me. And I remember like exactly where we were sitting. I remember like exactly what shirt I was wearing. Like it was one of those moments that like,
complete clarity.
Yeah. And it was totally, because I think, you know, he's always been like a very cautious person, and not one to take risks in a lot of ways, other than, for example, like moving to this country. But that was,
you know, I was just going to say.
Right, but I guess maybe the difference of that is that was, you know, years in the making, right? You know,
right.
A lot of planning,
very calculated.
You know, exactly right. Yeah, he's not a capricious person in terms of like, oh, let's do this, let's try this. You know, he's very kind of slow and methodical. But I think that, you know, something that I always viewed as a strength, but he was almost saying, is that I would have probably tried a lot of other things, you know, and maybe been happier in certain aspects if I had been less fearful. And now looking back on my life, I realized that a lot of that fear was completely just in my head, and I was imposing it on myself. And that's what, at least what he said when he said that, that's what it meant to me. And I was like, oh, wow, that's really, and the way he said it, there was almost like, he didn't clarify. I remember asking, I was like, what do you mean? He's like, nah, forget it. And I was like, all right, that's fine. But I remember like there was like that tinge of regret in his voice. Like it was tiny, it wasn't like sad or sorrowful, but it was just kind of there. And again, maybe I'm reading into it, but it was one of those phrases, just like you said, clarity, right? Like it had so much weight to it that the emotional tone of that, like I could kind of, I almost knew exactly what he was talking about. And I was like, and to me, that was like a Tony Robbins seminar in like 3 seconds. You know what I mean? I was like, oh, that's so,
yeah.
You know? It's like, how many times have I been, you know, held back from wanting to do something and realizing that it's just fear that I'm probably imposing on myself, and I'm just making it up in my head.
It's crazy to think, like I work with a few people who I work on that with them, because I can see how much their fear holds them back and how much of that, yes, absolutely, is in their own mind. And for whatever reason, like, you know, the seeds of that can come from family, can come from experiences they've seen others go through, can come from culture, whatever it may be. But I know I've had my conversations with them, and it's crazy to think about how many people are on this planet, in your community, in a state, or in a country that is built on a culture like that, that just don't try and just don't do things. And in some ways, like, I think there are probably a lot of those people that you could go up to and ask them, what are some things that you wish you had done or wish you could do or whatever. And if you said, like, what are the consequences if you tried that? And to a lot of them, you may just get a shrug, like, oh, that's a great question. I don't know. There may not even be any consequences. And yeah, like inner fears and whatever that may be, like there could be so many amazing things going on, even just between people and in relationships that get held back by fear. So that's huge that he said 100%,
that. 100%. And I think there's, I studied evolutionary biology for a long time in college. And I think that all of that fear, I think it's a real thing that's been hard coded in our DNA. And just like you said, it's in our culture, it's in religion, it's in society, it's even right now, it's on social media. Like it's there. It's there. It's everywhere. And it almost feels like it's getting worse in the sense of, you know, maybe tearing people down when they step out of line or what you think is the line. It all comes from, you know, millennia ago, we were all raised in small tribes, 20, 30 people. And if you said something that the tribe found questionable and you were cast out of the tribe, that was your survival. So over generations, we've been kind of bred to fall in line with the tribe, right? If someone over there is eating those berries and they're fine, and someone over there is eating different berries and they're, you know, turning blue and bleeding, you might say that, hey, I'm probably not going to eat those berries, but this guy's got the right idea, right? The more we fall in line, the stronger our survival. But now it's come to a point where a lot of those instincts are not serving us. Like, I shouldn't do this. I shouldn't step out of line. I think it's kind of like this vestigial sense in us from our hunter-gatherer days that doesn't really help anymore. But that's just my theory. Because that kind of that pang of fear when you want to do something, you're like, oh, I don't know, what will people think? You know, it's kind of a weird, it's a weird feeling to care about what people might think, mm-hmm. when in fact most people aren't even going to look at it or give a shit at all.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like it's like such an extreme, like the scenario in our head's not even close to what the reality is going to be. And most people, if they, you know, even look at what you've done, chances are you'll get a pat on the back rather than a, what the hell were you doing?
Yeah. And how many times like have you or I or anybody listening out there done that thing where you're kind of almost role-playing a scenario in your head and you're like, oh, I got to say this to this person, or I got to have this conversation, and I'm sure this is what they're going to do and this is what they're going to say or whatever. And then you finally break down and do it, and it just does not come out any of the ways that you said.
I think that's like a daily occurrence to me. Like what you just totally said. That happens to me like every day, and it's never like, I still haven't learned. Like I'm so thick-headed. I'm like, I'm like, I'm going to say this, then I'm going to say this, and I'm going to say this, then I'm going to fight. And it's not even close to that. Yeah. I think you nailed it. It's such a common experience. And a lot of us never learn. At least I don't.
Well, yeah. And that's, you know, it's the fight against our nature as humans, and as well as like the way that we kind of stop doing that is by putting it into practice continually and making something a new behavior and a new norm, as opposed to like, okay, this is what I'm used to doing. I'm used to thinking about this and doing this or whatever, as opposed to I'm going to take this leap and then we'll see how that goes.
Yeah, that's spot on. I've heard a lot of different kind of catchphrases for that, like, you know, change your paradigm, alter your frame, raise your baseline, right? And all means the same thing, that, you know, if you get accustomed to those new behaviors, it can be a very, very powerful, positive thing for you.
Yeah. And I think a lot of it too is like slowing down. And I don't think there's anything wrong with slowing them, some of those scenarios down to a pace where you are able to at least like say to yourself, this is what I'm going to do. And it doesn't mean like that taking that forethought and thinking through the situation is a bad thing. It's just that you're thinking through what you're going to do and your control points, which is never the other person. So like there's another human involved, how that's going to go, like God knows.
Right. Yeah. It could be anyone's guess.
Yeah. So, okay. So we've now solved the world's problems. and, let's go back. So you are born in the 80s and living in India, which I've been to, but I've only been to Bangalore. So doesn't sound anything like where your dad was or where you were.
That's, believe it or not, I spent years in Bangalore as a kid. Because when my dad grew up and he was living in the country, he moved all over, worked to different places. And then Bangalore was just kind of like the way it is now in terms of being like this bustling hub of commerce. Mm-hmm. So we lived there, and I still have a lot of family in Bangalore. And every time I go to India, I go back there. So that's great to hear that you've been there.
That's funny. Yeah, I used to have a job that we had production centers in the Philippines and India. And so I had to travel over there and talk with them every day and everything. I loved my friends in Bangalore.
Oh, nice. That's awesome.
Hello, Srinivasan, if you're listening.
That's a very Bangalorean name. I know three Srinivasans. Yeah, that's fun.
I know, and I've heard those people who are like, you know, once what was the code name for it? It was during an election. That whole thing became a big political mess in maybe 12. I don't think it was part of 16.
I think that sounds about right to me. Yeah, I remember that.
And even like when the company I was working with that was doing it, like we lost a lot of customers because they were like, you know, you can't take jobs away from America or you can't.
I remember that whole period. And one thing that really stands out to me is that there was this TV show called Outsourced.
Mm-hmm.
Don't watch much. You remember that? And I don't watch much TV, but I remember watching that show because it was really rare, especially at the time, to see a bunch of Indian characters on TV actually played by Indian actors. Right. And I remember watching it and I was blown away because they nailed the culture without being like, it was like the perfect, like there were characters that were goofy and serious. And it was like, I swear to God, every single one of those characters on the show, I feel like they looked at some of my cousins. They're like, you're going to be this person. You're like, it hit so close to home. And then I remember it got canceled because there was so much outrage that people were saying that it was insensitive to make a comedy based on people losing their jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember that. And like now, especially in hindsight, I think it's, you know, I feel for anyone that's lost their job. I just don't see the connection between they absolutely were not making fun of anything. They were showing, you know, a reality that, hey, these jobs are going over here and this is what the culture is like. And I was so upset when it got canceled because it was one of the few shows that I could watch and be like, this is not only funny, but it's like, this is what being in India is like. These are some goofy motherfuckers with big hearts. You know what I mean? Like it hit so close to home.
Yeah. I actually had to show, it was maybe a couple months ago, I showed my coworker who I share an office with a video on YouTube that was done by an Indian fellow. And I don't know if he was a comedian or not, but there were actually a couple that I could find that they were describing the head wobble.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
And the different meanings.
Yeah. It was probably Russell Peters.
Maybe. But I told him like the first time that I went over there, because I'd been talking to these guys on conference calls like every day and over email and whatever. And the first time that I went over there and was in a conference room full of these employees and where I was just talking and everybody, you know, everybody has their unique head wobble.
Sure.
And yes, they will do it for different things. And I would have to like ask them, I asked you a question and I don't know if you're telling me yes or no, like so, and all of them had their different speed and twist to it and whatever. Like I literally felt a little bit seasick because there was just so much movement in the room that was going on, and it made me feel like I should be maybe wobbling. It was really interesting.
That's I am going to tell that story to every Indian person. That's amazing. You're absolutely right. The head wobble's kind of like our aloha. It means like 30 different things.
Totally.
And there's each one's like a snowflake. Some are fast, some are slow, some are violent, some are suit. Yeah, I find the head wobble eternally fascinating.
I get it. It's a totally comfortable thing, and it's not, you know, I don't think that I got nods or shakes of the head either. It really was like, this is my yes is a twist and a slower rate. And this is my no is like really fast and tight.
And it's very it's interesting. Increasing your ability to decode body language too, right? Internationally. Yeah. So you're working out that skill set.
Yeah. So I hope that nobody listens to that section and thinks I'm being racist or anything silly like that.
You're talking to an Indian. I'm giving you carte blanche. You're good.
Thank you very much. And having been there and lived there, I feel like, you know, I'm not saying it as a mean thing.
No, this is all very in good faith.
Okay, and that is the end of the first half of my conversation with Amar. First half. This was originally, I thought it was going to totally work as a single episode, but as I was editing and going through everything, it just seemed like this is another one that I'm going to cut in half. And so here we are with another two-parter. You're welcome. So that means a lot of extra goodness and me not trying to cut out a bunch of stuff just to make it fit into a single episode. I think that just works better. And if you disagree, I am absolutely welcome to your opinion. And you can voice your disagreement with that to me in a variety of different ways. You can hit me up over email, my email address, that you can send me little notes of, hey, that was great. Or, hey, maybe you should try this. Or maybe you should lose some weight, or whatever you might want to say that's constructive criticism or just compliments or whatever it may be. You can send those to me at daddyunscripted@gmail.com. If you really want to go above and beyond and be that person, you can go onto iTunes and leave me a review, a star rating of your choice, and a review, because really, like, we all say this, but it really does help more people find the show. And that is part of what I would like to go back to, is the emails also help because they help me make the show better. Whether it's you telling me something that I need to change up in your opinion, or it's you giving me a guest idea, those are the best. So keep bringing those. If you have somebody in your life or that you know that I need to have on this show, send those ideas my way. Send me something and say, hey, would you like to have this guy on? He did this, or he's doing that, or his family is this, or whatever it may be. I hope you guys understand, not everybody on this show needs to be Matt Damon. They can just be the normal neighbor down the street that just has something different, a unique perspective, a unique life that they have lived that we can either be in awe of, or that we can maybe learn some lessons from, or that we can maybe take some insights and change the ways that we're looking at some things. All of these things are positive for all of us as listeners and for myself as well. So send those, don't be afraid to send me those ideas. You can also hit me up on social media, direct message me, whatever it may be. Go and find me in all those places. Find Amar on social media. Tell him how much you liked this episode, etc. You can go to his YouTube page and find him there. On YouTube, search him up as Amar Guitar. And you can find him on Twitter as Brahmin Noodles. That's B-R-A-H-M-I-N _ noodles. And make sure you follow him there and say hello. And you can tell him how great you thought this episode was and how much you're anticipating the second half. So the second half will take over right where this first half leaves off. It just made sense to kind of cut it there. The second half of this episode will be out next week. Okay, so you won't have to wait the normal distance that I put between episodes because this is all being edited all at once. So come back next Tuesday for the second half of this very good conversation with Amar. And the second half, we'll talk a lot more about music and what he's done and more of his life story. As the first half, a lot of this was kind of spent, I don't know. I wouldn't say we spent a lot of it on his dad, but it was more historical in nature than the second half. So don't miss out on that part either. Big thanks, as always, to Umphreys McGee for letting me have their music in all of my episodes. In the beginning, in the end, it's barely playing very lightly right now. You can hear it in there. Great solos going on. So check out umphreys.com to see more of them coming near you and all the great stuff that they are doing in 2020 as the year arrives. And I will tell you again, check out OsirisPod.com for the other podcasts on the network, and check out JamBass.com to find other live music that is playing near you. You should absolutely go see live music, a very important part of life, in my opinion. I'm just one man, but that's my opinion. So as I greeted you in Hindi, I will now say goodbye to you in Hindi. And Amar, you may judge me on my pronunciations of all of this, and I'm fine with that, but I will tell you Fir Milenge, which is goodbye. I could have also said Namaste, but that seemed too easy. I will also go even a little bit further and say Apka Din Acha Bite, which is have a nice day. So I'm really going above and beyond because I want Amar to grade me on these pronunciations. Or any of you else who speak Hindi. So let me know how I'm doing with my foreign languages. And to all of you, truly, have a nice day. Be kind to one another. And I will just say, as I'm going to add to the end of all of my episodes now, I will remind you, if you feel alone, if you think you need help in this world, if you or someone you know is struggling and you feel like they need help or you need help, I will remind you, first of all, you are absolutely not alone. You are not less for asking for help. It doesn't mean you're weak or anything like that. So the suicide prevention hotline is 800-273-8255. And I have a Google voicemail number, and we can figure out a way to talk. Or you can just say, I just need to vent. Don't respond to this. I'm just leaving this here in a safe space. And that number is 872-444-6784. If you deal with these thoughts on a regular or even semi-regular basis, put one of these numbers or both of these numbers in your phone. Make the contact name something that you aren't afraid somebody will stumble onto. That's a like secret code for you, and use them when you need to. Please, all of you are important. All of you are significant, and all of you are loved, and your place is here for a reason. Sorry to make it heavy. I'm just trying this out because of my recent suicide episode, and I'm going to figure out the best way to put this into every episode. But for now, it's right here. Again, I hope you all have a great rest of the week whenever you're listening to this. Make sure you come back next week for the second half of this great conversation with Amar.